Hello and welcome back to the Nowhere Office, wherever you are, with me, Julia Hobsbawm.
And me, Stefan Stern.
This is the podcast which looks at the world of work as it is, as it could be, should be, might be, with some of the leading thinkers and doers of the day. Welcome to a very festive edition of the Nowhere Office. I'm Julia Hobsbawm, and this is not Stefan Stern, unfortunately, who's in America while we're recording this episode. Who are you?
Hi, I'm Alan McLean-Jones. I'm one of the co-founders of Ashore, and I'm in loco parentis of Stefan today.
And you are, in fact, our sponsor partner for this series, so it's appropriate that you're here in lieu of Stefan Stern. And we are with a very wonderful guest. We are with Rory Sutherland, no less, the advertising guru, vice chairman of Ogilvy, guru, behavioural specialist, expert, wiki man. Rory, hello.
Hello, it's a pleasure to be on this podcast. And it's an absolute passion of mine, as you might imagine.
This whole question of future of work, and we are actually having a tipple because we record in Spiritland, which is also a cocktail bar. So I hope you'll forgive us, but it is the end of the year. What are you gentlemen drinking?
We're both on Dark and Stormies, which is the national drink of Bermuda, and was, I suppose, the original mule, wasn't it? It's rum and ginger beer, effectively.
Mean not the Moscow mule, because we don't talk about Moscow anymore?
No, that's right.
The
Moscow mule is with vodka. I think there are a few others, aren't there? There's some sort of tequila-based mule, but they're all ginger beer-based cocktails, but this, I think, is the original, probably.
I'm having a martini in homage to America, where quite a lot of this programme has come, this series. Are we feeling festive? Alid, what are you feeling as we end this calendar year about the whole state of the discussion about work, capital W?
Yeah, I mean, I'm both feeling festive as well. You know, night's drawing in. And this is also a great cocktail as well. I recommend it to any podcaster who's looking for something to drink whilst recording.
Set a bit of
recording.
A bad trend here.
Exactly. I do feel like certainly over the last couple of weeks, something's changed maybe months, in that, you know, very often since the pandemic, we've had this situation where every September, there's always a bit of a get back to school thing and a mindset that this time everybody would be back and we would be the kind of full 5 days a week, 9 to 5. And I think the toothpaste is still out of the tube. And I do feel that the debate's moving on now.
I mean, that's obviously good for business because you have a remote business. Tell us about Ashore for those listeners and viewers who don't know it.
Yeah, sure. Ashore is a platform.
Ashore.
Yeah.
Ashore.io.
Ashore.io, yes.
For those of you who want to Google it, or, yeah.
So Ashore is a platform that lets, you know, companies, employees, managers book stays in homes that are designed for productive and creative work. So imagine a lovely cottage in a fishing village somewhere, but it's got 1 gig internet. It's got, you know, best in class workspaces, and they're kind of designed to be places for people to kind of get away, focus on that kind of like strategic needle moving work, those big decisions that, you know, happen once or twice a year.
And it's working. You're not one of these startups that then has to kind of rapidly raise Series B because you've run out of Series A. It's working.
Yeah. We've got some great customers, great users.
So, I mean, I want to talk about the broader picture beyond the workplace, and because, as you say, that ship has sort of sailed, if that's the right metaphor. But Rory, you're not surprised, are you, that Alid's business is working? You always knew, as I think I did,
yes,
that the end of the office as was a bit nigh.
Well, I have the awful confession, which is I met someone very senior at Zoom in the summer of 2019. And we were discussing at the time, because I'd spotted that Zoom was the first real technology to cross the threshold of crappiness.
What does that mean? Well, that's a backhanded
compliment. There's a problem with, there's always been a problem with video conferencing, which is that when it was new and hyped, it wasn't very good. And by the time it became good, it was too late to hype it.
Right.
So you get this kind of problem, I think, with some technologies where there's an asynchronous hype cycle in that it attracts a huge amount of hype early on, then it immediately disappoints, okay? And then it sort of falls into kind of quietude. And the trouble is, when it then becomes good, and I think Zoom was good for a variety of reasons. One of them was technological. It was cloud-based. It was simply better. But the second reason was that it also used the meeting room model, not the phone call model. Mm-hmm. That apart from very close friends, video calling someone out of the blue or without prior arrangement is just too intrusive. You know, I mean, I wouldn't video call the chief executive of Rolls-Royce Aero Engines any more than I'd sort of jump into his office dressed as a clown and shout, surprise. It's just not an appropriate thing to do, okay? And so this meeting room model where you have a prearranged meeting and you all dial in was fundamentally more workable than the Skype model.
Mm. Or FaceTime.
Or FaceTime.
Okay.
Yeah. Certainly for business use. And effectively, it hit what I call the threshold of crappiness is when you basically go on the thing expecting it to work, not constantly worrying about something going wrong. So for sort of mission-critical meetings or important meetings with important clients, you couldn't really do a Skype call anyway because it would go wonky. And then you'd be blamed because I told you we should have flown to Frankfurt kind of thing. And Zoom was the first technology, I think, well, at least the first major one to cross that threshold. And so meeting this senior person from Zoom, we're discussing how on earth do you get people to work remotely more? Because in many ways, this is better in all kinds of ways, environmental, economic, etc. It's better than meeting in person.
And you have this conversation in 2019.
2019, pre-pandemic. And this is the tragic admission I have to make, which is we'd kind of arrived at a vague consensus that if you made Friday the Zoom day, okay, kind of thank Zoom it's Friday, because people were already working from home on Friday. It was a bit like, you know, don't ask, don't tell, but a hell of a lot of people didn't actually come in on a Friday. They worked from home. So I thought, okay, if you extend that and make Friday the Zoom day, then eventually you've solved the coordination problem of, you know, because it's difficult actually to Zoom with some people in an office and some people elsewhere. And that was the initial idea. And just as she was leaving, I just said, as if in passing, I said, of course, what you really need is a major transport strike or a minor pandemic.
Oh, golly. But it ushered in something that was a latent desire.
It was. There was the coordination problem, which is that if three people are in the office and one people are at home, the experience still isn't very good. There are a few interesting technologies kicking around, like the OWL, but mostly those hybrid, part round the table, part remote, they don't really work very well. Remote works very well, I would argue. Mm. And so
the data shows that all remote can work better logistically.
Yes.
It's hopeless for cultural cohesion unless you're all remote in a huddle in one of your cottages where it's team bonding, Aled.
Yeah, totally. Yeah. And I think I suppose that's it as well, isn't it? It's interesting just thinking about the conversation with Zoom in 2019 and then all of the this idea of the kind of found object, right? And what happened in 2020 with the pandemic was we had to just kind of pick up what tools we had in front of us. And that was Zoom, like a laptop, a hastily shipped monitor screen, maybe some, you know. And what's fascinating to me as well is how much better the technology is getting every year, right? And the experience is getting.
This is a really important point, which is people talking about comparisons now aren't envisaging what you might call, I think Schumpeter calls it gains to market scale. Mm. That once a market gets large enough, then the possibilities for innovation in that space. To be honest, I've been disappointed. I was expecting someone like Nikon to come out with blingy hardware that was kind of portable. I was also expecting more places like stations and airports to provide pods and spaces in which you could actually hold a video call while on the move. I haven't seen anything like the infrastructural change I would have hoped to see.
But we are seeing, especially through AI now, and I know that Microsoft Teams is doing this and, of course, Zoom and, in fact, all of those teleconferencing players, tracking your movements so that the slight clunkiness of being on a screen on a little box is being addressed. So they want it to be, I suppose the term is frictionless as time goes by. But you're right, it's taken nearly 4 years since the pandemic for that to be achieved.
I mean, Nick Bloom points out there are a lot of patents being filed in this area, so we should hope to see some of those come to fruition.
Yes.
But I haven't seen quite the extent to which I would have expected kind of pretty good, you know, let's say a portable connection of a thing which includes lights, a pretty professional microphone, headphones and a tablet stand, say, which, I would have expected to see.
The Ring Light, of course, made a star appearance at the beginning of the pandemic. And that became, if you like, the kit that was synonymous, wasn't it? That we all needed to look our best. I still have a Ring Light. It's always falling off my computer. I'm not very good at using it on the rare occasions when I'm no longer face to face. Because let's just talk a little bit about being together physically in an office. I mean, some of that has swung back, hasn't it?
And rightly. Oh, completely rightly. The question of serendipity is not a... I mean, it's sometimes used as... I mean, let's be candid about this, OK? There are a lot of people ranting about getting people back in the office. And yet those same people did no real experiments or gave no consideration to conditions that were amenable to productivity before the pandemic. Okay, so they show no interest in any consideration of experimentation with office space, with technology. I mean, interestingly, okay, most of the evidence suggests that open plan is actually a bad thing. Yes. And it doesn't even create the serendipity because there are always three people concentrating at the end of the table, so you can't have a chat. And my argument's always been that the perfect office is actually bipolar. It's like half pub, half library.
Yeah.
Because some people go into the office because they want to escape, and some people go into the office because they want to intermingle. And, of course, the same people want both at different times. Okay. And, you know, one clear piece of evidence is that open plan isn't very good, but they instigated it anyway because it saved money and crammed people in. Okay. And the other bit of evidence, which is absolutely clear-cut in terms of productivity, is that multiple monitors are a game-changer. Or having a lot of screen real estate is an absolute productivity game-changer.
And floor to ceiling.
Well, my monitor's not that big.
No, but floor-to-ceiling rooms for teleconferences.
Oh, I see what you mean.
Totally, yeah.
So that when you're actually on a call with people that are not in the room.
So I have the kind of absurdity where I go into the office and we have an open plan sort of table space, and I've got a little 13-inch laptop screen. And when I'm sitting at home, I've got a 55-inch, you know, 4K TV. Well, I mean, it's crazy that, I mean, it used to be the case that you went into the office in part because of the tech, because the tech in the office, I wasn't going to have a photocopier the size of a car or three fax machines in my home. But now your tech at home is better than your tech in the office.
But that's exactly the point, isn't it? That there is a different asymmetry in terms of the logistics and hardware design of the workspace, and that we've got better at designing our homes, those of us in the knowledge industry. You've made a business out of choosing premises that have...
Because you get a blingy chair, you get a monitor, a retina screen, don't you?
Yes, it's the setup. Every workspace will have multiple ones within a home, right? It's got like an Apple Studio display. We have this lovely sort of handmade desk, and then a Herman Miller chair as well, and then all the kind of accessories and cables and stuff as well.
So you're sort of like the Soho House of remote working. You've got a very particular high spec look. Everybody knows they're in an Assure kitted space.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, and I think it's interesting, you know, talking about the development of the workspace, because new products have kind of come to market. So, for example, the tables we started with, the Assure V1, are very different to what we have now. Similarly, the monitors as well. And I just, you know, I just want to say, like, I definitely agree with the point around that there has been, it feels to me that there's a bit of a slow take up on the technology side of things. But I do think it'll ramp up, you know, because we're talking about full length screens here, and I'm kind of thinking about VR, right? And it's interesting to me that Apple and Meta, their kind of big hardware bet now for the next, you know, five years is basically VR. And if you look at the way they're pitching the marketing there, a lot of that is around, you know, the kind of idea of being able to kind of, you know, work from anywhere but feel like you're in this room with people.
I think that's right. I think that there really is one stream that's dealing with trying to customize physical buildings, workspace. There's a lot of business for designers and architects, but there's no obvious pattern because you've got such different stock in buildings. That's why corporate real estate has been in such crisis.
Yes.
But at the same time, you have a sort of narrative.
I would hope that a lot of it gets turned into residential property.
Well,
there's a difficulty with that with natural light legislation.
Mixed use and rezoning.
Exactly.
So some of the time they will be in a fixed place. Some of the time they might be in a different country. I mean, will airline travel in the next 10 to 15 years be sort of wheels up movies, or will it be recast as pods where you actually have business suites where you work for a 9 or a 10 hour flight?
A lot of people would actually rather not see that, because for a lot of business people, the flight was a rare period of unconnectedness.
But my point is that the cultural acceptance that the technology allows us to innovate is also there, isn't it?
Yes. I mean, I think we're in a slightly undesirable phase at the moment, because in some ways, after the pandemic, we had a world where you have effectively two diaries. You have your virtual diary and your physical diary. Mm. And actually coordinating the two, once you have to allow for travel costs, which you never had to allow for during the pandemic, you simply went from one call to another.
And that you never thought about
that. That was a mistake,
pandemic,
by the way.
That,
was a mistake. You should always leave half an hour or so between meetings, because otherwise you've completely, literally forgotten what the first meeting was about by the time you finish the second one. I think there's a, you know, I don't think we understood well enough switching costs and the need to build in buffers. But I think this is an ongoing experiment. And I think what you may find is that certain businesses, it varies by job. It also varies by personality. It varies actually by individual, let's be honest. But I think we will see some sort of normalization around office sharing, for example, and some, you know, some businesses being on, you know, a Monday, Wednesday, Friday, some businesses being on a Tuesday, Thursday, alternating, however it may work. Some businesses do this thing where they have what they call core weeks, and everybody has to be in for 4 days of that week.
I think it's really hard to imagine that the status quo of going back to the office is going to hold.
That's gone for many people, unless you were in Goldman Sachs. And one has to question, of course, to what extent they're invested in commercial real estate and therefore have a vested interest in everybody being back 5 days a week. We have to be cynical about some of the material we read, because I keep reading these articles which effectively saying flexible working is finished. Okay. And you go, well, first of all, the experiment's only just beginning, and it will take years, literally, for us to get fully settled in a new equilibrium, partly because it's a network problem. I mean, the reason it took a pandemic to get us to adopt some of this behaviour is largely because, and this, Douglas McWilliams, the economist, writes about this, one of the problems we have in adopting new technologies is that a lot of new technologies are network technologies, and those require effectively synchronous, simultaneous behavioural change amongst a large group of people in order to be adopted. I mean, just for interest, the fax machine in the UK, it's always a joke in network discussions about network technology that there's no point in owning the world's only fax machine. And the strange thing when you do buy a fax machine is that the more people who then buy one, the more valuable your own fax machine becomes. And it only really got established in the UK in the 1980s, after a series of postal strikes, where effectively out of desperation, people thought, I guess we better buy one of those fax things. That's precisely why I said what you need is a transport strike or a minor pandemic. You need some sort of external shock.
I love your guilt there, Rory. Yeah. It had to be minor, didn't it? You didn't really mean
I did say minor. I promised that. And so you need some sort of external shock to get everybody to reevaluate things simultaneously.
Yeah.
Otherwise, you have this incredible sigmoid curve where the path of adoption is incredibly slow. Now, I can actually lay claim to one thing. I was a Friday Zoomer and got my team to do the same back in actually late 2018, because I realised, look, this is a game changer. And actually, if we choose to use it intelligently, it can cause us to rethink.
I raise you 10, Rory. I left an incredibly posh office in Somerset House.
Go on.
in about 2015. And it was partly, in fact, for family reasons that I needed to be closer to home more of the time at that time. And it was partly because I thought the internet affords presence. And actually, at the time, I ran an event company. Alid, when did you realise, you know, you were a mandarin in government, when did you realise that there was that coalescence and that you wanted to become not only an entrepreneur, but an entrepreneur gambling, as probably entrepreneurs do, on the future being these immersive, away from home, away from office working places?
Yeah, I think it was just noticing that there had been this kind of moment of crisis that had led to this, that had got us over the kind of collective action, you know, the kind of coordination problem point that Rory makes. And I think that just seeing as well, you know, people being able to, like, you know, think differently about the way that they kind of lived and worked, right? Like, a big catalyst for me in kind of leaving government and starting with Sure was we had our first child, right? And I was kind of like, well, this question around how do I, like, do what I want in terms of work-wise, but also, you know, kind of have that flexibility that I want became a very pressing one. So I think it was kind of, it was really that, really, just what, just, you know, maybe not looking at the kind of macro numbers and saying X number of people are coming back, is it going to revert back to the average 2019? It was more just seeing lots of people and saying, hey, hang on, they want a slightly different way of relating to their work and their life. There's probably quite a lot of those people out there. Let's see what we can build.
Of course, a huge rise in the student population is not insignificant, because as a student, you spend, you know, three or four years with this slightly blurry relationship between where you work and when. And there are people who go assiduously to the library, and there are people who work at home, and there are people who work in cafes. So it seems strange to go from that existence to an existence where 5 days a week, without fail, between given hours, you have to be in a particular place.
But I think we have to move out of actually talking about the physical bricks and mortar, because what is now, to my mind, coming into, to continue the metaphor, the room, is the technology, the gadgets. I mean, I've got in my hand, the listeners can't see this, I bought a Kindle Scribe, which is the top of the range Kindle. And I did it for two reasons. One is that you can physically write, and you can download PDFs, and I download a lot of academic papers, and you can then mark it up. And of course, you can get books. And I thought, I don't want to be distracted by the TV, radio, email end of things. So that's just an example. We're recording this in a studio that, when we began recording, the Nowhere office didn't have cameras. Now it's got cameras. ChatGPT-4, the professional model, came out a couple of weeks before we're recording this programme. That, again, is making radical leaps forward. So tell us about the kit and the tech that is transforming our behaviour, Rory.
Yeah, I mean, obviously, they're going to be different things. So there's the home-based kit where, as one brilliant person put it, you know, the home video setup, the camera, the microphone, etc., the backdrop, is the kind of $3,000 Italian suit of the 2020s. You know, that your rig, and to some extent, you know, the impressiveness of your reproduction and lighting, is to some extent becoming a factor. That's the home thing. Then there's the question on the move, which gets difficult, because there are weird people who'll kind of do these video calls while walking, without wearing headphones.
I like doing those for my LinkedIn.
No, I find it too weird. I find it really peculiar.
So there's being on the move, and there's being on the move.
Yeah, and there's also there are also three spaces, aren't there? There's home, there's your conventional office, and there's the third space, which is somewhere else, whether it be a cafe or indeed a studio like this.
Our series partner for Series 5 is Assure, which is a remote location business that makes remote work easy. Do look them up and check them out.
So being able to time shift like
Right.
is not an irrelevant thing, because, I mean, I learned this, funnily enough. I had a PA, a brilliant PA, but she was a single mum. And I said, OK, well, look, I'm weird, OK? I keep weird hours. I have, you know, slightly eccentric kind of patterns of behaviour. What works for you? Because I said, look, if you want to get in a bit late and take your son to school or pick him up early, that doesn't bother me at all. Because I said, to be honest, I'd rather you were above ground and phoneable in an emergency than on the tube. But then equally, her son would go to sleep. He was quite young. Her son would go to sleep quite early. So I used to send things like my expenses and anything bureaucratic. I'd actually send her home. And the point was, she could then get on with the form filling while her son was asleep. OK? And so we both had, between the two of us, what you might call a kind of mutually beneficial time shifting. And, you know, the upside to me was, look, once every 3 weeks, I'm going to call you at 11 o'clock at night, OK?
Yeah.
Because that's how I roll. And you're not going to complain about it. I'm not the world's most woke person, but, I mean, one of the most extraordinary things was how unfair the previous working arrangement was to parents of children, mothers
totally,
in particular.
Totally,
yeah.
You know, it was completely unreasonable, really.
We're back. We've time shifted. And Rory made the very, very important point that the flexibility that is really remaining post pandemic and way into the fourth year after COVID-19 is a flexibility of approach to how we work and the value of the work that we do, and really isn't anything to do with the bricks and mortar.
It's a little bit of a strike, I'll be honest with you. I think it's a little bit of Labour reasserting itself over capital because it's collective bargaining power.
Well, we've
you,
seen
you
a
couldn't
rise.
Bargain individually and say everybody else is coming to the office 5 days a week. I want to be the person who goes to the seaside on Fridays, okay? You had no bargaining power as an individual. When collectively you've all proved you can do it, you have quite a lot of... And by the way, this is unusual because I always say this. I'm the only sort of avowed conservative in the advertising industry, but I'm also the only person who continually speaks up for labour over capital. Because I think that the conditions of people in office work have been continually eroded, okay, over the last 25 years. Now, one example of this, okay, is that in my childhood, it was perfectly possible, indeed normal, for even people in working class jobs to maintain a household on one salary, okay? You then had the two salary household, which was great for the first years. But it's now led to a position where unless you have two salaries, you can't possibly afford to set up a household. It's just genuinely impossible, unless you're some sort of, you know, plutocrat, okay? That's then taken away, okay, what you might call 35 hours of discretionary time a week per household, which was previously put either into the household or indeed into the community. Okay, it was typically done by women. There was no reason why it had to be done by women, but that's how things worked in sort of 1955. And you had this discretionary time and people who were effectively devoted to quality of life, and one person went out and basically earned the money. Okay, that's now impossible. So you've lost 35 hours per household per week. Add commuting, it's more like 43. Okay. Then you have things like the BlackBerry and other things which have effectively... In 1988, when I walked out of the office, you couldn't really work. You could write things on a bit of paper and you could make a phone call, and that happened about once every week or so. But effectively, once you left the office, that was it. Your time was entirely your own. Now you have effectively, you know, people working for free. It went with the invention of the BlackBerry. Every single person who commuted in by train in the morning in 2001 read a newspaper. I would describe flexible working as a benign strike action, kind of collective bargaining power, which is obtained by simultaneous behavioural change. In other words, you couldn't individually bargain for flexible work, but now effectively there are enough people who can threaten to leave if it's taken away from them that the power of capital over labour.
You're okay? Not a conservative, you're an anarchist, aren't you?
Yeah, no, well, I'm an anarcho-syndicalist. Yeah, anarcho-syndicalist. I'm also a Georgist, by the way, which we can also bring in, which is that Henry George was a successful economist in the sense that he actually got some degree of real political take-up in the United States in the late 19th century. And his insight is that, which is a very weird feature of economics, okay? Everybody from Marx to Adam Smith to Milton Friedman to whoever you choose agrees that rent-seeking is bad. It's an extractive, not a productive part of the economy. And yet not a single economist or government ever does anything to curtail it. Now, what George's insight was that whenever you have any form of economic activity which is dependent for its performance on its location, the greater gains of that activity go not to the person performing the valuable function, but to the person who owns the land on which it takes place. And so he believed there should be a single tax, which is a land value tax, on the unimproved value of land, which should effectively cover all taxation. Now, it's not that far from the way the Singaporean government works, so it's not totally outlandish. There are clear proofs of success. But my argument is that a large part of what drives economic progress is when people can escape from the depredations of landowners. Now, most of my younger staff, after they've paid tax, 50% of their after-tax income disappears into basically property and transportation costs. Accommodation and transportation take up 50% of what would otherwise be discretionary income. Okay? Now, that's a second tax, effectively. Okay. And it's a London tax in particular. And I've always thought...
A city's tax.
It's a city's tax in particular, because land isn't necessarily that expensive if you can live anywhere, okay, as the American West shows, you know. Now, what's actually happening, I think there are really significant technologies, one of the biggest of which was the car, which freed you from effectively rent-seeking based on your location. Now, When you watch, do you watch Little House on the Prairie ever?
Of course
you do. We love it.
You read all the books.
But what always fascinated me, and I couldn't quite understand it, was why they hated the Olsons so much. The Olsons were the shopkeepers. Do you remember? And then I suddenly realised this was the pre-car age where the Olsons had them over a barrel because they ran the local shop. And if you wanted to buy anything, it was either a horse ride for 2.5 hours or you paid the Olsons inflated prices. So the Olsons were effectively rent-seeking. And as soon as Henry Ford came along, the Olsons didn't have that stranglehold anymore because you could just get in your Model T and tool off in any direction, okay? Now, there are various technologies which are really important because I call them George's technologies. Now, the high-rise building is one, to some extent, okay? It means that actually the actual value of the land itself is less critical a part of the accommodation you provide. Trains are mixed because trains undoubtedly led to suburbia and a huge expansion of London, but also trains are centripetal. They're hub and spoke and they concentrate footfall in one place. Airports are even worse, OK? The people who make the money out of the shops at Heathrow aren't bloody Louis Vuitton, whatever. It's the person who owns the airport, OK, who has the stranglehold over that particular footfall.
I think that everything began to change in the run-up, if you like, to this, to the pandemic unleashing absolutely everything. For me, was 2007, the iPhone, Airbnb, and the publication of Tim Ferriss's The 4-Hour Work Week. Yeah, totally. Because that, to me, was the beginning of the celebration of mobility enhanced by technology. Now, it may have been, to your point, Rory, a repudiation of the economics of being, you know, tied into property and unrealistic costs. And we are seeing that now, aren't we? We are seeing that people do not want the commute and they don't want impossible living costs. But it
Or they don't mind the commute if it's 2 or 3 days a week.
But
there's
a very big difference.
Yeah. There's a very, very big difference between commuting into from Folkestone, say.
Right.
It, 5 days a week, I wouldn't touch it. 3 days a week, I'd give it some serious
Absolutely.
Thought.
But my point is that I think we have to factor in not just the pushback against negatives, but the embrace of the positive. And I think that this entire age we've come into, which technology has, you know, obliged us by assisting, is an embrace of mobility, flexibility, freedom, choice, dipping in and out.
And yeah, so this very pessimistic take on everybody needs to get back to the office, people are shirking.
Yeah.
Is extraordinarily
I think
Luddite.
It misses the mark.
I think it's interesting, isn't it, when you talk about the car and the power of the car and how it's seen as kind of in America in the 50s, 60s, it's like a symbol of freedom, you know what I mean? And I think that
it still is outside the M25.
Totally. And I think we're still,
we actually have to finish. We're running tight on this studio. So time is not something that has been radically changed at all. Still 24 hours in the day, still limits. Gentlemen, we're coming to the end of the programme. We're coming to the end of the calendar year. Are you optimistic or pessimistic about what's coming down the track in terms of work? Never mind where work takes place. Never mind, you know, whether we've got silly bosses or enlightened bosses. Are we feeling optimistic with all of these shifts? I think I am.
I'm not.
I have
a problem, which is that, one, I don't think capitalism works without optimism. I think unless you have slightly naive optimism, capitalism just regresses into this kind of, you know, finance function, cost control exercise, where you drive meaningless efficiencies out of things to a point where nobody notices at first, but in the end, you haven't got a business.
So you're with Hannah Arendt, really, which is society has got to have meaning and work is part of the social meaning and the vita activa.
And secondly, I think that the level of experimentation that's going on is depressing, in that if there's one thing you should be doing now is trying different things and seeing how they work, because we don't know. It's absurd to formulate a kind of policy without experimentation first, okay? And the one thing that depresses me is because effectively everybody wants to have the right answer straight away.
So you seem to think, am I right, Rory, to finish on your point, that the way we think about where we work and when we work and what we work with
is potentially a source of significant productivity improvement combined with quality of life.
But it's also
there's no trade-off.
But it's also a metaphor for the very system in which we live and work. It's a metaphor, really, for capitalism's functioning. That's what you're saying.
And the reluctance to experiment is deeply depressing, I think.
Aled, do you agree with that? Because you come from a more techie community.
Yes, yeah,
I think they're experimenting and iterating all the time.
I'm short-term pessimist, long-term optimist. I'm going to hedge my bets here. I agree that like the world is, you know, ultimately to really unlock the benefits here, things are going to have to get a bit stranger. And I think I do see like a bit of a lack of risk taking. But you do get those companies who are breaking out of it. And I think the story for work as a whole, I think long-term, I'm quite optimistic about, and I'm quite bullish on the ability of kind of like AI to like automate away a lot of the kind of, you know, a lot of the drudgery and keep it and, you know, and allow humans to kind of play this kind of very strategic and creative role. And I think, you know, ultimately that's quite an exciting future for me in terms of work. So I think that we're still in this period of experimentation. I think it's quite painful. I think we should be experimenting more. But long term, I think, you know, it goes back to what you say, Rory, about the market is the market, right?
And it's a market.
And we just have to...
And there's a job market.
And it's going to happen.
Okay, we now have three variables to talk about. Actually, a fourth one, which I'll also mention, which is how utterly economically stupid retirement is. That you have to choose an arbitrary date, go too early and you run out of money, go too late and you just replace a life of work appointments with a life of medical appointments.
Well,
so you have to choose the date of this absolute hard and fast retirement date. People tapering off would make inordinately more sense, okay?
Well, they're sort of doing that a bit in Japan.
I mean,
in a way, you could argue that the role of robotics certainly in places like Singapore is being used to mirror the more realistic decline physically. But we are out of time. We're going to have you back. Rory Sutherland, I don't know what you would have been like without your... What was your cocktail?
It was a dark and stormy.
A dark and stormy. Well, there's another one of those coming up.
Official sponsor the podcast.
For those not looking at this podcast but listening to it, Rory is wearing a beautiful pink cable knit jumper. And in fact, he's a bit matchy-matchy with Alid, who's wearing a purple Patagonia sweatshirt. I thought it was only women that unconsciously synchronized. Very cliched.
Me rocking this, yeah.
Alid McLean-Jones of Ashore, Rory Sutherland, thank you both very much. This has been the festive edition of The Nowhere Office, recorded in the studio with dark and stormies and martinis, I'm sorry to tell you. I'm Julia Hobsbawm. Stefan will be back with us in the new year. This is a fully connected production. Our production house in London is with Spiritland and Ed, and we have in Miami, in the ether, Kevin Hersholm. Thank you.